Thank you. I think we can control all those peanut diseases in North Dakota, no problem. Our yields and profitability aren't very good. But I want to talk about Fusarium head blight and some of the adoption of practices related to its control in spring wheat in North Dakota and Minnesota. And I think the reason that this was included in this symposium is because although this is not a real recent kind of issue to deal with, it is an issue that became problematic about 20 years ago. We've been able to develop recommendations for controlling it, and now I've had a chance to kind of sit back and look at what is working and what hasn't, and I think there are some lessons learned for other kinds of new issues that arise. So Fusarium head blight is a relatively new challenge in spring wheat and barley, at least in North Dakota and Minnesota. It's largely saprophytic, which means that it's not real specific. It will carry over on crop residue very nicely. Affections arise from residues of small grains and corn, and corn, I think, is probably one of our biggest sources of inoculum. And we obviously have had more corn move into this area of the U.S. in the last few years, and maybe that's one of the reasons that our problem has become greater. But it's also dependent upon warm, humid weather. We've had some climate change in that we've had more moisture come into this particular area of the state in around that time when wheat is most susceptible. And that's really at that flowering stage. In addition to causing yield reductions, it produces DON, or it's a vomitoxin on the infected kernels. And really in barley, it's the DON that is the problem, and not so much the yield reductions per se, because any DON level in the barley will make render it unuseful in malting. But Fusarium head blight can impact yield. It usually starts as a point infection and it'll spread up. The resistance that we have in our new varieties that have some level of resistance would be what they call a type 2 resistance. And it would stop the spread. It would allow, you know, some infection to occur, but it'll stop the spread. And as I mentioned, it's really not a yield-reducing issue in barley, but it certainly can be in wheat if you get it to occur at high levels at the right time. And probably more problematic than yield would be the fact that you get DON levels in your grain, both wheat and barley, anything above one part per million in material that goes to food into the food industry would be unacceptable. A lot of this will mill out. You know, a lot of the DON actually resides on the external part of the kernel, and so you, I think basically if you're at the two part per million level on the grain itself, you can probably get your flour down to one part per million and it would be acceptable. Well, in 1997, so as mentioned, the problem arose about early 1990s. And so in 1997, the problem persisted enough during those early 1990s that there was sufficient support, that funding was provided by the U.S. USDA, and they formed what was called the U.S. Barley, Wheat and Barley Scab Initiative. Greater than $4 million annually is provided to support a wide range of research, from breeding fungicides, IPM, research on genetics of the pathogen, etc. So in about the early 2000, we started to have recommendations available. So you can see that process of the problem arising in the early 1990s. Some research ongoing, a big infusion of funds in 1997, and then about early 2000, we start to have some recommendations. And they consisted of probably most exciting were the partially resistant varieties, also fungicide programs, the development of a fungicide application technologies. You know, what's the best way to put fungicide on when you've got a target just ahead of the plant? They developed a Fusarium head blight prediction model. Rotations can be helpful. We heard mention of the disease triangle. So if we can rotate, we can reduce the level of pathogen inoculum load. And then staggering planting dates and heading dates. And that simply provides a little bit of risk reduction because, you know, you're not always going to have perfect environmental conditions for the development of Fusarium head blight. And so if you can stagger those dates, you might likely reduce the risk of getting an infection. Those recommendations were extended by many approaches, grower meetings, extension publications were prepared, ag media, advertisements about fungicides through the private sector, web-based resources, both public and private. And as I mentioned, are there lessons to be learned for extension programming that can be learned from the experience that we've had? And so in early 2009, a survey was conducted to determine the levels of adoption of recommendations and how farmers obtained information that they used for controlling this scab. The survey was just a simple questionnaire that was given to participants at a wheat meeting. I think we had about 202 meetings, and this was about January of last year. We had a total of 161 respondents from many counties in both North Dakota and Minnesota. About half the farmers attending responded. It was a simple 12 multiple choice questions. So what were the findings? And this first comment here deals with giving you a sense of how farmers view scab as a problem. They reported that it was problematic to them once in 4 years. We had about half of them that would say that was the case, 33% once in 3 years. And so you get a sense that about 80% of those farmers would say it's not a problem that we have to deal with every year. And I think this is going to impact on how they adopt technology as well. So it's not something you have to deal with every year, but it's something you have to worry about at least once in 3 years, once in 4 years. What did they adopt? And here we're just allowing them to say what kind of management practices are they adopting. We didn't limit them to the number of responses. We see resistant varieties, 82%. That was the most the highest level of adoption, followed by fungicides at flowering. Rotation, 63%, so pretty good adoption there. So this is rotating either out, you know, they're not following either wheat or corn. Planting varieties with diverse flowering dates, you know, we're getting down to where not many folks are involved in that kind of practice, and then staggering planting dates, most would say that, you know, that was not something that they did. And you could imagine there's a number of reasons for that in North Dakota, because you don't have a very long growing season. What did farmers perceive was the single most effective practice? And as you can see, that resistant varieties came out to be the number one. Here we only gave them the one choice, and they chose far and above the use of resistant varieties, followed by fungicides at flowering. Rotations would be down there about 18%. We're saying that might have some effect, and planting date not particularly high. Now, so we've had about 10 years since we've had varieties out there with some level of resistance, and you can imagine they rushed to adopt resistant varieties, and then after a while we have new varieties coming in. Some of those don't have resistance, and so the temptation was to move out of resistant varieties. And so this question then dealt with, you know, if you've used how do you go about selecting wheat varieties in your farm? And these are the typical responses. We select a variety without concern to scab. We're not that concerned about it. We're either going to deal with it with fungicides, or we'll just take the risk that comes with us every 3 to 4 years. So we're dealing about 10% in that range. About 20%, all of the varieties, they only use resistant varieties. We have another 10% that are using some, but not all. And I think the biggest group starting to emerge is you have a little over 40% that would say we select varieties based on yield first and then scab resistance as a second factor. So have there been disadoption, meaning that have you used a resistant variety and then decided to move away from resistant varieties? You can see that over 60% of the respondents had experienced that movement. And why did you stop growing a resistant variety? You have scab, this green bar. The feeling was that scab was not a sufficient need to be worried about. The other group, around that 5% group, scab takes, fungicides are adequate for control of scab. And probably more important would be that they had other characteristics. So if you had a variety out there that they had other characteristics they liked that didn't have scab tolerance, they went with that particular variety. And then the final one of the same level of importance would be they felt that they were inferior in yield. I think the take-home message there, and it's always the challenge that plant breeders have, isn't it, is that you've got to develop a variety that's as the top yielding out there with the resistance, because they don't want to give up yield for disease resistance very readily. And of course, this survey was done, I think it's also important to note that it was done after 2 or 3 years of kind of scab-free circumstances. You know, when you've had a very serious year of scab move through, people start thinking, giving more emphasis to scab than when it's been a few years. These are, yeah, they don't add, that last one didn't add up to 100 because that's a percent of those respondents, of the total respondents, and we only had, 60% of those that disadopted. Okay, let's look at fungicide use. When did they decide to use fungicides? Our biggest group would be when farmers themselves considered it favorable for scab development. So we had about 45% of the farmers that put fungicide on when they felt it was favorable for development. We had about 20% that apply every year. These are like those peanut farmers that want to spray 7 times. These are the ones that spray every year just to be safe. And it's a scheduling issue in many times. You know, a lot of our wheat has to be sprayed by airplanes because if it's wet and susceptible to scab, that means you probably can't get your sprayer out there. And so, you know, scheduling at the right time is critical. And I might say that the application timing of fungicides for scab control is very critical. You know, you have to really put it on right at flowering, and it only gives you a few days either side of flowering to be optimum. And so I think that may be one reason why people would move forward with an every year as well. One was every year on susceptible varieties, about 10% of those. When the disease forecasting model indicated, you can see that's a fairly low percentage. And when consultants indicate. So I think a lot of the farmers are still just basically applying when they feel conditions are favorable. How is it applied? By ground, by airplane, or the vast majority prefer to put it on by ground. I think our control is a little better on ground because we put on a little more gallonage, get better coverage of the head. But, when you can't get out there in the ground, then you've got to go with the airplane. You can see that, about 10% of them were saying, if I would prefer to put it on by ground, but if I can't, I'll put it on by plane. Let me just mention about the disease forecasting model. This has been developed, and it assesses the risk of infection based on past weather data. It's not predictive in the future because, you have to more or less know what the future weather is going to be like. It's nested, this, at least in North Dakota, this disease prediction model is nested within a heavily used, what we call, North Dakota Ag Weather Network. So farmers are very used to going in on the internet and looking at this Ag Network data. So it's just one more option available in that. It's updated daily. It's been available for more than 3 years. And risk of infection takes into account the susceptibility to cultivar growing. This is just a screenshot of that disease forecasting model if you went in and specified where you're located in the state and specified, then you'd have to know more or less your flowering date, because that's the critical part. You want to know relative to where flowering is, your susceptibility. You can see as it comes up, it'll give you the date and the likelihood of risk of Fusarium head blight developing. Any of those red bars would indicate a high risk. If you've got a very susceptible cultivar, you can see that you've had a long period of high risk. Usually about three of those in a row would indicate you ought to be out there spraying. And again, as I mentioned, it's not forward-looking. It's based on past data. And so you've got to kind of come in here and say, well, my flowering date might be out here in September 22nd. I've had a few, several days preceding that that have had in that high risk range, so I'll go out there and spray. Okay, so that's kind of the model. I've been pretty excited about that. A lot of good work has gone into the development of it. But let's take a look at how the farmers have used this disease forecasting model. Never heard of it. We had 10% of the respondents, and I was a little surprised because I think we talked about it in the meeting they were at, so I'm not sure why they would indicate they'd never heard of it. Heard of it, never visited the site. That's probably our, one of the bigger groups. Visited the site but never used it, so at least we got them to the point where, hey, let me take a look at it. About 30-35% of them regularly visit the site. So this, hopefully there are some farmers in this group, but you know, we didn't break out farmers or consultants, and so it might be that some of these are, you know, university people or consultants. We got about 15% regularly visit it and use it in making a decision, and we had about 5% that say they only spray when the model indicates that they should. So a lot of good work. Pretty minimal use of the model, I think, at this point. So here's where I'd like to, the information that I think has some application. It's been very interesting for me, at least, to analyze, you know, where, the question was, where do you get most of the information that you use in making your management decisions? On this Fusarium head blight, 70% suggested extension meetings. So we're feeling pretty good about that, but I guess we have to be a little cautious in that, you know, we'd ask this question at a meeting. You know, this was not a letter sent out to just randomly selected people. But they, I think also it might bear in mind that these are new problems, fairly complex problems. And so you can understand why they like the face-to-face interaction in getting their information. Crop consultants and extension publications feature very highly. Personal consultations with county agents is still pretty significant. You know, when you get down here to publications from other companies and elevators, internet, these are all coming in kind of low. And you know, I'll come back and talk about that internet factor there. Okay, so I guess that then comes to my conclusions as to how we might apply some of this experience to other areas. First, I think the frequency of the risk is a motivating factor in the adoption and disadoption. You know, we've gone through a period where scab hasn't been as problematic in recent years, and so we're probably seeing some folks saying, well, I'm not nearly as concerned about it. I'm going to pick up some of these varieties that don't have resistance. And so we're seeing some of that happening. I think it's very easy to understand that farmers are reluctant to give up yield for disease control. especially in a scenario where it's only one in three or 1 in 4 years where a scab shows itself. Important to note that extension meetings, at least in this group that we surveyed, are an important way that farmers learn new technologies. Even though we've moved into the era of internet and cell phones and all of those things, they still like to pick up new technologies through some traditional face-to-face meetings. Crop consultants are becoming an important group, and I think the suggestion here is that we need to make sure that in our training programs that we include them as a group. Should also be targeted. Extension publications, these are hard copies for the most part, are still valued very highly, so I think we, let's not leave those behind. Another conclusion is the internet is currently not considered by farmers as an important source of information about Fusarium head blight control. And the disease forecasting model is rarely used, even though the vast majority of the farmers knew about it. And, my question there is, it is computer-based delivery of information. We probably shouldn't be a primary source for at least some of these emerging issues. At least in North Dakota, we have some folks maybe that still like some of the traditional approaches. And I just posed some questions at the end that I have had as I reviewed these data. Why is internet importance so low? Is it information readily available elsewhere? If you're getting it at these meetings and other sources, why do you even worry about it going to the internet? And that may very well be the issue here. I think we did a good job of, getting the information out there in a number of different media, and so perhaps that's one of the reasons that that the internet is not considered so important. And the other point there was that some of that internet information is connected with the model. And, I suppose that for farmers that have, we're not like peanut farmers that have been spraying a long time. Maybe that model is just a little bit too complex. Not experienced with it. And maybe the use of internet is low for ag information in general. I think that we're well connected in North Dakota. We don't have particularly fast connections in most places. I think most farmers check email and check the price of the commodities, but it may not be something that they routinely use for collecting information on how they manage their crops. So I think with that, we have a minute or two for questions.
I have a question. What do you use as the background for your model? Is this the Fusarium model that was developed at Penn State?
Or right. It's the same one. Okay. And we have our, we have this North Dakota Ag Network I described. I think we have, all of our counties have at least one weather station. And they use, that drives the model that Penn State put together.
Sean, one of the co-developers of the SCAB model was Len Dransel, who was a professor at North Dakota State University, and he had actually worked on the other disease, the transplant leaf rust and Septoria, and those models were already running on the end-on system. And then this model was added to it. This model, in the case of SCAB, is only one of the different age varieties on the susceptibility, basically their disease rating. And then the weather, the Pennsylvania model actually works on the NOAA weather data. The end-on system for a long time only relied on the local weather data. And so for a while, you actually could get different answers depending on whatever data set of weather you used. Because we actually had the NOAA weather data is basically metadata and very broad, where the end-on weather data is much more local. And as you well know, thunderstorms in the Great Plains can fall 2 miles away from you, and you can have 3 inches of rain 2 miles away from you, but nothing at your spot. And so that's been one of the challenges with the strength of the model.
And I might say that I think the Penn model also, they are trying to be more predictive in that as well. In other words, I said you, this is all working on historic data, but I think they've got it set up so that it's also kind of take into account what might, you know, what the weather predictions will be for the next few days. Yes, sir.
Is your forecasting model take into account the previous crop, or is it just?
It does not in this case, but one could, you know, one could see that it would.
There's a risk factor that
There's a narrative with it that in the model that says you should also consider this as you are trying to make a decision, and in the narrative it says, you know, about the previous, the risk of the previous crop and everything else. This is just the weather, you know, whether or not the conditions are right on that triangle. And then you have to modify that. And I think you're actually understating the use, because one of the things you can't peel out of the data is that this model's been running a couple of years. We've been doing this for 10 years. We've been telling growers for 10 years. And what I've seen with previous work in the Netherlands with EpiPrey from Zadox was that you have this first 2 years where there's a learning, where the learning actually occurs from the growers, and then they assimilate that, and they don't need to look at the model anymore because they can walk out to the field and they know what the conditions have been, and they're smart enough to figure out that they basically can predict the same way that the weather forecasting model forecasts the disease. And so you see this adoption of the model, not because they're not interested in the model, but they learned their lesson. And you can't peel that out of this data.
Right. And I think that fusarium head blight is as such that, you know, if you stand out there and you know it's humid and it's warm and it's raining, yeah, we're going to get head blight. So I think you're right. I mean, some of these diseases, you know, you need to have more time for incubation and those kinds of things. And I think also that there's a lot of, even if you're rotating, you tend to have a lot of spores about. You know, you'll still get scab even if you've never grown corn or wheat, but it won't be perhaps at the same level. And I think that, you know, you could see that they could adapt that, you know, just the same way they adapt with susceptibility of varieties.
We're just north of you in the valley in Manitoba, and our issue the last few years has been not lowering, but hoping growers have realistic expectations about what these spray programs will do. It's quite often just produce higher yields of scab infected wheat. And a year ago, we had very poor control. We just ended up getting more of the junk in the combine, where if we had not sprayed, more would have gone out.
And that's the biggest challenge with managing this disease. I've been thinking of this ever since I started my career, is that the best chemistries give us only 60, maybe new, now with the newest ones, 80% suppression. And so if you have scab bed where you actually have, normally it's human cyclical, in other words, initial effects occur, spreads in the head, disease is done. But those initial infections, I've seen it where you can have up to 7 initial infections on a very resistant variety. Okay, that's still a 50% damage to that head. And when we use fungicides, we can have those 7 initial infections. We might take 5 of them out, we still have 2 left. And if you then, you know, you still have VSK, you're still going to have visually scabby cones. And it's always confounded with tan spots. If we're unlucky, it's confounded with leaf drops. So you have higher yields because you took the other things out of the equation. I don't agree with the assertion that we shouldn't have sprayed it in the first place.
Yeah.
This thing is still being trained.
And I think our challenge now as well is, you know, to integrate what we've got together and move it along. And it didn't capture that very well here, but, you know, using resistant varieties and fungicide and making sure you have a decent rotation, that helps you. But you may still have, even with the best technologies we have, you can still have a train wreck. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.